And we are back. Thank you for joining us. And it's time for yet another of my favorite parts of the show. The favorite parts of doing the show is somebody joked with me and they said, Zach, I think that you started a radio show just so you could get people to come on. And I was like, well, that's not entirely untrue, right? It's certainly a big benefit. But joined by a repeat guest that's been with us before, but it just put out a recent report. I've been wanting to check in with him, and I figured this was a perfect opportunity to do it. So without further ado, Mr. Edwin Dorsey of the Bear Caves Report, correct?
Bear Cave Newsletter.
Yeah, the Bear Cave Newsletter. And before we get going, let's give folks a little bit of a reminder about, because you are incredibly young to be doing what you're doing. But, you know, at the same time, investing is an art, is a skill that is typically found with folks that are of an older age. But there are plenty. I try to explain this to people that, like with investing, it involves talent. It just does. It involves not to say that everybody can't be a decent or a good investor. I think they can if they're disciplined. But there's talent with it, like anything else. And we've seen multiple examples of these young people coming in and doing really solid work and making waves. And you are no exception to this, my friend. So first of all, why don't you give us a little update about your business and how much it's grown since you started? When did you start doing the report?
I started the Bear Cave Newsletter in February 2020. So I was a senior in college, and this is 1 month before the pandemic started. So one way I got extremely lucky starting out is I started my newsletter just before the pandemic. And the pandemic was the best time ever to launch a newsletter. People were bored. People were online. People were looking for something to read. So that's kind of the early ways it started to get big is, you know, people were bored and on Twitter, and I was tweeting out like links to my newsletter, you know, which mainly focuses on exposing corporate misconduct. And that's the early way it started to grow.
And then just as a refresher too,
yeah,
you are, you're a research reporter, but how much does your personal investment book follow? Are you a short seller in your own practice? Because you have that makeup. Short sellers, I am convinced, people are like, well, Zach, you short? Yeah, occasionally, but it's not anywhere close to the majority of what I do, right? Not even close. But would it be fair to categorize you as a short seller?
I don't think that would be how I would describe myself necessarily. Okay. So I have a lot of experience working on the short side. I've interned for a lot of short sellers. I know a lot of short sellers. I was mentored in college by a lot of short sellers. Now, the unique thing about my newsletter, the Bear Cave, is I actually don't bet against any of the companies I write about. I don't take positions. I don't short the stocks. I only make money from reader subscriptions to my newsletter. So I do invest on the long side a little, and I typically don't talk about that. You know, I would say it's a little tough to categorize what I do because no one really exactly does it. There's activist short sellers and they take positions, and there's like journalists, but that's like pure journalism. What I do is like somewhere in between the two. You know, it tends to be what I do in the Bear Cave is I'll typically look for $1 to $10 billion publicly traded companies that I feel are misleading investors or harming customers in some way and write articles criticizing them. Typically 1500 words, typically document based, very qualitative. So I don't really discuss valuations or even numbers that much. It's like qualitative aspects of a business. One thing I'm particularly good with in the newsletter is using the Freedom of Information Act to go to state regulators to get consumer complaints on a business. For example, maybe Planet Fitness has complaints about gym membership cancellations, or an insurance company is price gouging people, stuff like that. That's what I really focus on in the newsletter. And then there's a free version that goes out every Sunday where I'll summarize new activist short reports, highlight notable or suspicious executive resignations, and link to some interesting tweets.
Now, again, because of your – and for people that don't know, and you can probably speak to this even better than I can, short sellers are a different breed. They are a different breed. And the reason I think that they're a different breed is, A, they're looking at the markets and they're looking at things through a completely different lens. I personally believe it's one of those things that you can sort of learn how to do, but if you're not naturally that way, you're never going to be able to compete with those guys that – in my opinion, that were born that way, right? That's just the way they see the world. They're also tend to be the best researchers because if you get a short wrong, your downside is infinite, right?
Yeah.
It's why I always crack up when I hear all these stories about these evil short sellers. Uh-huh. You know, you're looking at them going, man, this has been the longest, biggest bull market in U.S. history. I don't really think the evil short sellers are really messing you up. So to that logic or that line of thinking, do you ever see yourself? Could you feel yourself feeling an attraction or a desire to try your hand on the short side at some point?
I mean, if I wanted to make the most amount of money possible, I should probably launch a hedge fund or a short biased hedge fund. It's tough to earn more money than like running your own fund.
Yeah.
So there's that. One reason that I don't do the active short selling route and instead do what I do with the newsletter and paid subscriptions is I think I'm better at the early stage of research, being heavily document-based. If you look at what these activists do, they typically publish a lot less frequently, but do deeper work. They'll hire private investigators. They'll like talk to ex-employees. They might even, you know, they'll go to this extreme like length. And, you know, the risk there is a high risk of being sued. Activist short sellers are sued all the time. I've luckily never been sued. You know, I think there can be like some regulatory scrutiny. As you know, there's been like for years now, some sort of investigation into some short sellers and their trading activity. You know, a lot of times short sellers, they don't just take a position themselves. They'll partner with another fund to take a position and get like a profit sharing agreement. And I think that can be, you know, a little questionable.
A little sticky.
So I like what I do because it's a little more journalistic. It's a little more honest. It fits my kind of mold of trying to like push for corporate accountability. And it's like fun. So for the near future, I think I'm going to stick with my newsletter model.
Got it. Okay. So before we get into the specific things about your recent report, what do you think when you're researching in this market? Do you see... What are you seeing? Would you consider it a target-rich environment for shorts? Do you see a preponderance of shenanigans going on? Do you not see that? Or is it indescript? I mean, do you not really see it that way? What are you seeing generally out there?
Well, Zach, as you know, there's always going to be fraudsters and charlatans and people trying to scam. So that's always a target-rich environment.
Right. Right.
I would say the easiest time ever for me in the newsletter is when we saw a lot of SPAC mergers. That was easy picking. All I need to do is open up 10 SPAC mergers, find the most egregious, and write on that. Generally, I like to say when there's more retail participation in the market, it's easier to find articles. So kind of in the GameStop mania, I never criticized GameStop, but then a lot of retail investors started getting money and wanted to throw it around. And they were investing in like clearly like fraudulent companies or scammy companies. And then that made it a target-rich environment. SPAC mergers were easy. Also, when the market's going up a lot, then there's a lot of inflated valuations. So that's good. I have a preference for writing on recent IPOs or SPAC mergers. So because that's kind of died down a little, that makes it a little tough. You know, one thing that makes it easier for me is I focus a lot on businesses with like auto billing problems or, you know, high renewal prices or like scamming customers in some way. And that is still very prevalent. So that's where I focus a lot of my time. So it is a target-rich environment. I think it was a more target-rich environment maybe a year ago or 2 years ago, but there's still a lot to look for. And there's still a lot of companies in this like $1 to $10 billion sweet spot that I think could fall 80% plus.
Oh, yeah. As far as being target rich, I think that's valuation fundamentally. I think there's so many different places go ahead.
And Zach, there's a lot of change in the world too. We got AI, which I think is going to be a positive for most companies, but could be a negative. There's the GLP-1 weight loss drugs, which, you know, I think is going to have a big effect on a lot of companies in healthcare. You know, even for like liposuction companies, or like there's going to be like Weight Watchers is being affected because now it's easier to lose weight and you don't need it. There's going to be a huge downstream effect from these weight loss drugs. Anytime you got a lot of innovation, there's going to be some big losers. So that's what I also look.
Yeah, no, that there's that without, yeah. Whenever you see these big trend shifts, you know, there's going to be a lot of people jumping on, right? I know you're probably well versed, but you know, you saw that a lot in 99 and 2000, right? Everybody was changing to .com, mm-hmm. right? You get a lot of shenanigans. Hey, have you done any work diving in? I'm sure you have, but the crypto uh-huh. space?
I mean, I look at it tangentially. So my kind of issue is I really just focus on publicly traded companies. That's what my readers care about. That's what the subscribers care about. So it is Talk about a target-rich environment, Zach. There is no shortage. I just see this stuff, like, and it's so, so egregious. The only problem is, back to what you were saying earlier about short sellers, is there not really a profit incentive to expose the shenanigans in crypto, because you can't make money shorting it. There's no way to make money by exposing it. It's not even clear if you can make money being a whistleblower on it. So yeah. There's tons of shenanigans. There's this YouTuber, CoffeeZilla, that's constantly exposing it. You know, I do kind of look at some of the Bitcoin miners and stuff, but unfortunately, there's not, I've criticized Coinbase in the past. There's not too many publicly traded pure play crypto things to criticize.
Gotcha. Okay, so let's flip to the report, okay? Because yeah. I think this is a fun one because it's one that everybody can relate to. Mm-hmm. It also deals with innovation. To a certain degree.
Yeah.
It deals with household. It deals with, this is a fun short. I think this is a fun short idea. And I think it's a great idea for people to get their hands around the concept of short selling. But before I do that, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you one more thing. Yeah. Have you spent, now this is just purely my own intrigue talking here.
Yeah.
You've had to have looked at AMC at some point.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, help me understand what all the is this all about them thinking that synthetic longs that are created when guys take a short interest, that's fraud? Is it that simple?
I think it was really that they thought, like, they were just doing the GameStop 2.0 playbook. GameStop, dying retailer, huge short interest. They were able to catalyze a short squeeze and the stock went from 3 to 300. AMC, kind of like a dying movie theater chains, huge short interest. They thought they could catalyze a short squeeze in some way and the stock would go to the moon. And it did rise a bunch. But then, like, you know, catalyzing a short squeeze doesn't actually change the value of business. It's not how you build true value. So there's, like, all this idea of splitting off the stock and preferred shares and, like, a digital token dividend and all this, like, you know, I think at one point they were saying that shareholders would get, like free popcorn, like, certificates. And how could the short sellers replicate that, like, popcorn dividend? There's a lot of craziness, you know. I tend to, in my newsletter, I like to focus on off the beaten path things. So I like writing on things where no one else is talking about it. And, you know, AMC, GameStop, it's just, even though I think the businesses might do bad in the long run, if everyone's looking at it, it's too risky that the stock could just go up 200% for no reason.
Yeah. Yep. And the ideal target is finding a company that everybody thinks is fine that isn't. Right. That's the other side of the spectrum we want to be on. No, I was just curious. I was going through this saga has been playing out so long and I've just completely ignored it because I'm, you know, it's a really simple deal.
Yeah. Right?
That thing's going out of business. It's a zero.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just that simple. That being said, I've heard all this fraud talk and I hear him talk about these fraudulent longs and I was reading through it going, wait a second. Is this all about them not understanding that whenever you short a stock, you create a synthetic long?
They
think that's fraud. And you're like, no, that's what happens, guys. That's the way the accounting works, right? Like it's the mechanics of it. Anyway. And that was essentially, wasn't that kind of the fraud thesis behind it, right? Was the synthetic longs?
Yeah, I think people just don't understand that you can have a big short interest naturally in a company, or like you can even have a short interest over 100% in a company.
Yeah,
short share, there's a new long share. And yeah, I didn't, you know.
I just ran across that and I went, oh my goodness, these people don't understand the way this works, and they think they've uncovered fraud. And you know, you feel bad for them too, because I tried to, you know, I've tried to intervene a couple times and not do it in a rude way, but just, you know, on Twitter a couple times, I said, hey man. You've got this all wrong. Back away and take the L and just, you know, live to fight another day, but they don't want to hear it. They are apes, right? So anyway, let's move on to yours. So why don't you walk us through what your most recent report is? Because you've been working on this one a while, haven't you?
Yes. Very
okay,
true.
So now I'm obviously a junkie when it comes to this stuff. So walk me through the whole process. What first caught our eye, what first clued us off? Then I know that there was probably a first wave of research you did, and you obviously found some smoke there too, you know, or not in fraudulently or whatever, but just walk us through the progression of how you got to where you're at today as far as putting that report out.
Okay, so the company I criticized most recently was Hershey. And we can talk a lot about Hershey as a business, but the simplest way to explain the short thesis here is there's this YouTuber, 25-year-old Jimmy Donaldson. He's a very popular YouTube channel called Mr. Beast. Any parent listening to this has probably heard of it, you know, and I love his content. I love watching YouTube, even though he primarily caters to maybe like the 10 to 20-year-old demographic. I love it. I think it's really interesting. And I watch all his videos. I watch a lot of YouTubers. And when I saw he was coming out with this chocolate brand, which launched in January of 2022, I was like, that's interesting. Like, let's see where it goes. And then he started promoting it more and attacking Hershey in his videos. And I thought, you know, I wonder if this could have an effect. So the original thing is I was looking at him and there was a lot of other creators creating, like, you know, consumer packaged goods brands. There was Logan Paul who had this drink Prime. There was, you know, there's now this other guy who's creating a sweets business. There's a bunch of, there's Happy Dad and Alcohol by a YouTube channel. There's all these creators creating somewhat big CPG brands. And I was wondering, I'm like, who's going to be affected most? So I start looking at all the YouTubers and their brands, and I look at all the big CPG companies. And one of the big problems for like big consumer packaged good companies is they tend to be very diversified. So it's like, even if you believe Logan Paul's Prime drink, which is doing a few hundred million a year in sales, would take a lot of share, it's like, that's not going to destroy Coca-Cola or PepsiCo,
right?
Because it's so diversified among Sachs. But the one business that I thought was most primed to be hurt by this like creator product revolution was Hershey, with Mr. Beast and Feastables. And to go over like the maybe the basic numbers around Hershey, Zach, is Hershey's $40 billion publicly traded company. It trades at 27 times earnings. It's very popular, pays a steady dividend. You know, it's kind of seen as just a royalty on like America's chocolate cravings. Really great performer over the long run. You know, it's a very steady business is how it's kind of perceived in the market. And, you know, $40 billion market cap, they do about $11 billion a year in sales. $1 billion is international. It's almost all domestic and it's almost all chocolate. So the sweet part of their business is $8 billion every year in U.S. North America chocolate sales. And within that, they have two main brands. They have the Hershey bar.
What is total annual revenue for them?
$11 billion. So $11 billion total. $11 billion total revenue, $8 billion is North American chocolate. The other part is a little bit of international and a little bit of like a salty snack business. So they own Skinny Pop and Pirate's Booty, and those were like acquired. But the big part is it's actually not that diversified. It is just North American chocolate. And of that $8 billion in North American chocolate sales, about $6 billion is Hershey's bars and Reese's peanut butter cups. They own Hershey's and Reese's. And that's like basically the like kind of the crown jewels of the business, Hershey's and Reese's. They also own Mr. Good Bar and a few other small, like Almond Joy. But the big thing is Hershey and Reese's. And that's the thing that Feastables is going to be most primed to compete against. And like what's really interesting here is so Feastables, Mr. Beast chocolate brand, you know, it started getting a lot of sales and it's been very good at getting distribution. Right now it's in every Walmart, every Target, and most 7-Elevens in the United States. So it has outstanding distribution. And then more importantly, if you're going up against Hershey's with $8 billion in North American chocolate sales, everybody who's like an investor is going to say, huh, like even if he gets big, there's no way he gets to the size of rivaling Hershey's. But in just 2 years, based on the information I can piece together from his podcast appearances and news reportings, it seems like Feastables is doing around $500 million a year in sales after just 2 years of launching, which is like unheard of. And the thing is, it would be doing a lot more, except it like sells out nonstop and they have like trouble keeping it in stock. And my general view is, hey, if this guy's doing $500 million a year in sales after 2 years, it's growing like gangbusters. Maybe it's doing $1 billion in sales a year from now. That's totally going to impact Hershey's numbers. Like some of it is creating a new market, but there's definitely people that would have bought a Hershey's bar, and now they go into Walmart, and there's the Hershey's bar here, and there's the Feastables here, and they're going to choose Feastables over Hershey's. This coming Halloween, you know, if a parent is going to be handing out candy, they can do the Hershey's bar and be boring, or they can do a Feastables, and everybody in the house is like, and their block is going to love them. This company, and not only is it going to like take sales, I think Mr. Beast is doing a very effective job of like destroying the Hershey brand. So the Hershey brand, a lot of these big companies, they're really advertising companies. You want your brand to be associated with fun and happiness and whatever. But Mr. Beast, like in his videos, in one video that has like 150 million views, and most of his videos get over 100 million views, in one of the videos, he goes to a contestant and says, I'll pay you $100,000, you know, to do a bunch of challenges. And one of the challenges was, tell me which is better, Feastables or Hershey's. And he needs to take the Hershey's bar and throw it in a trash can. He's always saying Hershey's sucks, Hershey's tastes terrible, Hershey's is awful. To hundreds of millions of kids, you know, Hershey's is now associated with like being uncool and terrible. There's no amount of advertising that can like, you know, offset your hero saying Hershey sucks, don't eat Hershey's. And I thought that's going to be a huge issue. And then the bigger thing is Wall Street doesn't even notice, because Wall Street is largely like old middle-aged men who, like, I don't think they get Mr. Beast. That's one of my frustrations, is I'm really talking about this a lot in my newsletter, and the reception is so cool because it seems like such a wild idea that a 25-year-old YouTuber can really make a dent in a 140-year-old massive company.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh yeah, we just froze up for a second.
Okay, I'm here.
I've got a sketchy feed. You know what? Let me do something real quick. I'm gonna close this out and restart real quick. And let me send you another link. It keeps freezing on me, and I feel like we'd be better off doing that. So I'll send you a link in like 30 seconds.
No worries. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Edwin. Hold on. All right, we had a little technical difficulty, but we're coming right back at it here, and we should have had, I think we got it all squared away. But let's pick up where we left off. So you were running us through Hershey's. You and I were talking about, you know, the going through the sales and in 8 billion in North America, that they're primarily, I mean, that's their game, right? Mm-hmm. You're talking about how Wall Street seems to be resistant to this idea. Everybody seems to be ignoring this kid. And the reason that this was so intriguing to me is I'm watching this take place in my own home, right? Yeah. I'm watching my kids want Feastables. They got no interest in Hershey, none. As a matter of fact, you brought up Halloween, and I was like, I guarantee you my kids are going to tell me to buy Feastables at Halloween. And I like Jimmy too. I think he's a great kid, and I think he does a lot of really positive things. Here's the other thing I was going to ask you, and this is one of those things that I think is going to be a big – well, so before we go though – what else do we need to know about Hershey's? So we got through the 8 million. Finish up. I just want to make sure we've got that covered.
So I mean, a few more things on Hershey's. Outside of this thesis, my thesis is really about Feastables. I think Feastables is the main thing that's going to cause the stock to fall. I mean, it trades at an aggressive valuation, so there's a lot of room to fall when you're trading at roughly 30 times earnings. They also face headwinds from a few other factors. Cocoa prices have tripled or so in the last year, and that's a big input cost. You know, there's a lot of talk about these GLP-1 weight loss drugs that work as appetite suppressants to help people lose weight. Some people believe that once you start taking these, your desire for Hershey's and unhealthy snacks is going to go down. So, you know, I think that might be a small headwind for them. The other thing is Hershey's is pre-Feastables was already a business in decline. Their volumes of like Hershey's Bar and Reese's would go down about 1 or 2% every year, and Hershey's would offset it by raising prices 7% or so every year. So, you know, as every parent who does some grocery shopping probably knows, the candy section just keeps getting more and more expensive. You're not imagining it. But that's kind of short-term games that I think can really bite you in the long run. And Feastables is a little more expensive than Hershey's now. I think the cost might come down over time as they scale up. But, you know, so the Hershey's, I think, is already kind of a desperate business. They did a few acquisitions of like a Skinny Pop. They like to say there's tons of innovation, but really their innovation is just finding new ways of packaging Hershey's and like Reese's into some weird things. I think there was like even a Reese's flavored graham crackers, or like Reese's and pretzels. Like that. Like when you're doing these like 50th like possible potential partnerships, that's kind of a sign like this is a mature product that doesn't have a ton more room for growth. You know, I'm not a real fan of the leadership. There's just nothing. It's just this business that's begging to be disrupted, and you've got this guy coming. And I think the typical Wall Street criticism of my views on Feastables is three things. First, they say this is a creator brand. They very rarely get sales. It's never even going to get $1 billion in sales. That's unheard of. And while it's unheard of in the past, I don't think that, like we said, Feastables is already doing ballpark 500 million based on what he said in various media interviews. So it's huge and it's getting bigger and it's selling out all the time. So we know it has sales. The other thing people like to say is it's not going to get distribution. It might sell a lot online, but it's tough to get distribution. But we know from like various sources that they're in at least 15,000 retail locations. They're in every Walmart, every Target. They're often sell out. They're in a lot of 7-Elevens. They're in a lot of Albertsons. So they have tons of retail distribution. They even hired two executives recently, one of whom was the head of global Walmart sales for Hershey's. That person recently joined Feastables in January. So they're getting big players in the industry who have like experience getting a lot of distribution. So they have the sales, they have a distribution. And then the third thing everybody in Wall Street likes to say is, oh, Edwin, let's say they get big and they start getting sales and they're popular. What always happens in this case is the incumbent will use their billions of dollars of cash to do an acquisition, and then this will fuel the future growth. But the thing is with Hershey's, I think there's 0% chance Hershey's will ever have the chance to acquire Feastables. For one, Feastables is actively attacking Hershey's nonstop. If Feastables would be sold to Hershey's, it would just every kid would be like, what the heck? You just told me they're terrible. Now you're selling to them. The whole purpose of creating Feastables is Mr. Beast has Crohn's disease. And, you know, a lot of this candy is not healthy for you. It's not good. And he wanted to make a candy that is healthier and better, and, you know, is consistent with someone who has Crohn's disease. And, you know, he's obviously not going to sell it. He's 25. He's young. He's repeatedly said, his manager has said that they wouldn't even take a multi-billion dollar acquisition offer. There's no chance this gets sold. So these kind of traditional Wall Street criticisms, which would probably work for other creator brands, don't apply to Feastables, which is why I really think this could have a big impact. And most importantly, no one on Wall Street talks about it. This has not been mentioned on a single earnings call. This has not been mentioned in a single press release. Anytime I mention it on Twitter or in my newsletter, I get so much hate from people saying, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't understand. So I really, really think this is going to be something in the next year that totally takes Wall Street by storm.
Yeah, a lot of those complaints, I don't think these people understand it. Has Hershey's ever put out anything on YouTube that's had 50 million views?
No.
Probably not.
Like people, if people say, well, Hershey's can get a Super Bowl ad. And I'm like, Mr. Beast videos are like a Super Bowl ad every 2 weeks. And more importantly, like, if you love the guy, and it's like, that's so much more valuable. It's like, this guy, someone on Twitter was like, you don't understand. Hershey's has $1 billion marketing budget. Can't they just spend more on ads? I'm like, no, you don't understand. There's no amount of spending on ads that can match Mr. Beast. Mr. Beast is getting 30 billion views across all different platforms every year. That's insane.
This is my favorite part of the thesis, because anybody saying that, Hershey's is the little guy in the ring when it comes to marketing, not Mr. Yeah. Beast. His marketing budget for that's zero. Yeah. And he's still smoking them, right? He doesn't have to drop a dime in marketing over what he's already, you know, putting into his content and things like that. Right. I mean, he does one of his deals where he gives away $1 million or whatever, and he's got everybody eating Feastables, and it doesn't cost him any more to do that. Right. And he's going to have 100 to 150 million eyeballs on every single one of them he puts out. What is that? What Hershey's is spending a year is $1 billion in marketing.
I think that number might be a little high, but it's a lot. They spend a lot of money on marketing.
I mean, that you look at it right there. I mean, what an advantage he's got. And I don't think that he could do this with just Hershey's. I think he could do it with there's probably a list of several other companies he could do stuff like this to. Because like I said, that captive audience, he's got more eyeballs on his stuff than any human being on the face of the earth. You can't buy it. I mean, Hershey's could up their marketing budget to $2 billion and they wouldn't touch it.
I totally agree. And if you actually look at other YouTube creators, there's a smaller channel with this guy, Ryan Trahan, which is about like 1/100 the size of Mr. Beast. Or, you know, 1/10. And he has a new, just recently released candy brand called Joyride Sweets that is more like, you know, sour strips and that sort of thing. And it's like, okay, like, you know, Hershey's is almost all chocolate. It's like Mondelez, PepsiCo, and other ones that have like the other snacks. But it's like that could get share. You know, there's Smart Sweets, which is like a low sugar variation of like candy that is also getting popular that isn't owned by the big CPG players. There's a lot of room for YouTubers to come in and create these brands. Mr. Beast has said the reason he focused a lot on chocolate is the margins are good, the market size is huge, and there's just been no innovation. With other candy, you've seen innovation. With chocolate, there's literally no innovation. It's like just dying to be disrupted.
He's a savvy guy, especially for his age. It's really impressive. The other thing that he's got going for him is, in my opinion, it's good content too. It's family friendly. I'm not worried about my kids watching his stuff. And he's got that kid army behind him. I was actually having a conversation with my children, my two boys, about Mr. Beast, because they love him, right? And it, like you said too, when they want to watch something, so my wife is gone tonight. She's going down for a friend's birthday party in Palm Springs. So my daughter's staying at her friend's house. So we're having guy night, right?
Yeah.
Inevitably in guy night, we will watch some Mr. Beast videos because they love it, you know? And then I usually like to mix in a military video, you know, just because I got to teach them the way. But it's one of the things that we can watch together because it's good entertainment. It's clean. Uh-huh. He's funny. He does some really, over the top stuff. The other day he was giving away a guy a Lamborghini if he could protect the Lamborghini from a squad of shooters.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's fun. It's really smart. But they were asking me how rich I thought he was. And I said, I think he's as rich as he wants to be. Right? Meaning, I totally agree with you. I think he would get a bigger kick out of telling her she's no than he would taking the bid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he doesn't need the money. I mean, literally, he could be worth, I think he's probably a billionaire already, right? Mm-hmm. And he can, you know, he could increase that another 4 or 5 billion if that was his goal. I mean, so I don't really see Hershey's as having a muscle advantage over him.
Zach, I completely agree. And you're so right. He's very savvy. So he was actually on the cover of Time Magazine last month. And in the Time Magazine profile of Mr. Beast, they said he's earning $600 to $700 million a year. And it's grown like crazy. And 70% of that comes from Feastables. So that's where you get like a $400 to $500 million a year number for Feastables. It's like, that's insane. And there's so much room to like increase that. Especially if he rolls out other products. Like there's rumors he wants to make like an app development company or even video game company, because that's like very consistent with his audience. And, you know, so there's huge room there. And then the other thing is, everything he does is run at a break-even cost. He doesn't actually, with the huge amount of revenue he comes in, he always invests it for bigger and bigger stunts in the videos. Let me give out 100,000. Let me give out 500,000. And the new Prime show is going to give away $5 million. And that contract with Amazon Video for like his new series that's going to be on Prime Video, it's like supposedly worth $100 million plus. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just investing in more and more extreme content. And anyone like you who watch Mr. Beast over time, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, invest more and more and more. And it'll be fascinating. And he himself, like, he lives inside his studio. He lives and breathes. It's not like he's a very extravagant big spender. He's just totally, he's maniacal focused. He's the exact type of guy you don't want to compete against. You want to compete against the guy who has three houses and is partying. You don't want to compete against the guy that lives and breathes destroying Hershey's. And that's what Hershey's is competing against.
Yeah, no, and he's got the other thing too is he doesn't care about margin. He doesn't care about margin. And he's right not to, because adding, you know, if he adds a certain sector to his business that grows the overall, you know, his overall umbrella, and if it does not bring an ounce of profitability, it's more than worth it to him, right? Just because he's just growing his tent bigger and bigger and bigger. And the last person on earth I'd want to compete against, like you said, is a boundless energy 20-something who doesn't care about stuff, doesn't care about how much money he makes, and just wants to take on these entrenched names, especially when he's got a much larger megaphone than they do.
Yeah.
I mean, it just seems ripe for the picking. One of my other questions is, are you familiar with how his, and we'll get back to the Hershey's deal too, but are you familiar with how his Mr. Beast restaurant has done, the Beast Burger deal?
Yeah, this was actually another criticism I got when I kind of brought up Hershey's. Is first, they're completely separate. Feastables, privately owned company where he's the majority shareholder. Beast Burger, completely different. That was more of a marketing agreement on his end, where there's this company called Virtual Dining Concepts. They run a series of ghost kitchens, and they partner with big celebrities to kind of be the face of these various ghost kitchen brands. So Beast Burger, you know, basically this company, Virtual Dining Concepts, would go to existing restaurants, a lot of them being Applebee's or something, and saying, hey, we're going to create this like Uber Eats profile for Beast Burger. Mr. Beast is going to promote it heavily. And then you guys, existing restaurants on the back end, will create these things that people can order.
Right.
And that it went well at first. It was getting a lot in sales. Then the issue with these like virtual dining concepts, and as you start to grow, is there's a lot of quality control issues because you don't control the restaurants. It's done by third parties. And then from there, Mr. Beast kind of wanted to grow slower and have better quality control, better control over like, let's grow slow, let's get this right. And the third party who he licensed it to was like, no, we're going to get this as big as fast as possible, quality be damned. And then he just refused to stop. He just stopped promoting it. And then there was litigation where the third party says, oh, no, you're backing out of your deal to promote this. And he's saying, well, you're not ensuring good quality. And it kind of became like a little stain on his reputation. But, you know, to me, it makes sense. But then everybody says, well, if his burger chain didn't work, then Feastables isn't going to work. But I'm like, no, it's so two completely different things. You're just showing how little you understand about this business.
Well, yeah. The other thing, too, is to compare a restaurant to any other kind of business, regardless of whether it's a ghost restaurant or whatever, that's just a horrible mistake to make, right? I mean, just generally speaking, I'm not sure if there's a worse business to be in.
Yeah.
For the restaurant. Like, okay, so, you know, and like you said, his burger, he didn't have a burger chain. It wasn't his burger chain, right?
Yeah.
He probably made a couple tens of millions of dollars just slapping his name on it. And give him credit too, because why, at least from the story, one of the things that incentivized him to do it was COVID, right? Trying to help out some of these restaurants that have been shut down and, you know, things like that. It couldn't have diners in or whatever. So, everybody's going to take a few swings at a couple things and they're not going to necessarily pay out. But Feastables isn't fitting that profile at all right now.
No, he's not just marketing an existing chocolate. This is his thing. He's developed it. And actually, you know, if people are familiar with Feastables, just a month ago, we came out with this new formula for it, new packaging, new formula. I don't know if you've had the new one, Zach. It is, to me, phenomenal. Like,
really?
I love, and I'm sure I've done a taste test with like 10 different people. Everyone loves the new one. There's 7 flavors. My personal favorite is peanut butter. You know, it is so good. Like, absolutely amazing chocolate. And that was kind of the big complaint about the first bar. It's like, oh, I love Mr. Beast. I'll buy it, but I don't know if it's great. But this, literally, if you go to like Walmart, you know, here's an example of how just far off people are when it comes to criticizing Feastables. One person said in my like Twitter replies, oh, go to Walmart. Look, it has a bunch of negative reviews. And I go to Walmart and I look. And it's like the negative reviews were for the old bar. And since they launched the new bar, it's like all 5 stars. Someone's even saying like, even if this wasn't Mr. Beast, I don't want to buy the Feastables instead of Hershey's because it's just so much better. And I'm like every single criticism, like it just isn't true. And I just don't get it.
Well, here's the other thing that I would just think that people, okay, so if the first formulation didn't taste good, he still got to 500 million in sales, right? So now that it does taste good, like this really feels to me like it's one of those things where no matter what he does, they're just going to keep dismissing it, right? And they're going to keep pushing it down because there's no way he can take on the incumbent. But he is. He is.
And it's just like people just aren't like used to seeing a $40 billion company out of nowhere getting taken on by a YouTube creator. So it's like there's a saying, what's it called? You know, some people on finance like to say, never believe this time is different because it never is. And that's the thing. And to be fair, I think most of the time, this time is different. People who say that, it's not true. But occasionally it's right. And when it's right, it's really right. And I believe this time is different. I believe this time with Mr. Beast, who has a bigger reach than anybody realizes, with the products that are better than anyone thinks, going up against an incumbent that's staler than anyone thinks, this time is actually different.
Well, it's absolutely different. And here's the one, it's multiple in different ways, but I think the one biggest thing that is unequivocally different that nobody can argue is tell me when somebody could put an idea or a product in front of 150 to 200 million people and make money doing it.
Yeah.
That's never been done, right? So it is 100% different this time because nobody's ever had the ability to connect and get their stuff in front of that many people and make money doing it, right? Like just the advertising part. Where I look at that, that is such a massive advantage. And what it gets my mind to going or thinking about is I think a lot of businesses better be careful because that's an advantage that their money doesn't really help them. right? In that scenario, their reach, their scope, it doesn't really help them, especially on the marketing side. And the way the internet's gone, the way YouTube's gone, the way social media's gone, people are realizing, right? Data and eyeballs, right? It's the two most valuable, you know, things in the world. And have you looked at, it seems to me like this would be sort of the first salvo of this happening. I would think that you're going to see more and more of these influencers and these guys on YouTube making similar charges. Like you said, a couple other coming up with brands. Have you run into any other that approach his ability to push this? Do you think is he going to be a unicorn, or do you think that he's the first guy stepping through a door that he's kind of paving the path that many others are going to follow?
I think he's going to pave the path that many others will follow. He's going to be the most successful by far, but it's definitely going to inspire other people. And the thing is, if you look, the groundworks for this have been being laid for years. So like another example that isn't really tied to one creator, but is tied to the idea of influencer marketing, is this beverage company called Celsius Holdings that makes the Celsius drink. This company basically came out of nowhere with this like healthier, like energy drink that's very popular, especially among like the female demographic. But among like everyone, you know, kind of like maybe a Red Bull alternative and like, you know, seltzer-y. That came out of nowhere to now doing a few billion a year in sales, all just on the backs of influencer marketing. So like, you know, they go to the big Instagram models and whoever and say like, hey, use a Celsius in the drinks. And it got huge that way. Like if you look at Celsius, let me just pull it up here real fast. It's like a $20 billion company. Celsius drinks up 6,000% in the last 5 years. Zero like traditional marketing, TV advertising, all let's partner with big influencers and creators and get them to like, you know, make this go viral. So that's, and you know, now it's going to take on like the Red Bull and Monsters of the world, you know, and it's like there is this big like sea shift change. Prime is another example where Prime, I think, is going to take share a little bit from everybody and not from one particular brand, but it's like, that's huge. Kids love it, you know? And then the other thing, this criticism that some people have is when you're tied deeply to an influencer, then, you know, you ride the wave of that influencer's popularity and decline. And what I think people who don't watch Mr. Beast content don't understand is this guy is very evergreen. I think he's going to be popular and relevant for 10, 20 plus years. So you're merely much making a bet on Mr. Beast. But unlike other influencers who might have their things become popular or not, I think he is just going to get more and more. He's doubled his influence just in the last year. There's no one nearly as big as him. This guy is out of this world good.
How many followers does he have on YouTube?
I think he has like 250 million, and he's the first person ever past 200 million subscribers.
Well, do you know the what is the rough equation, the kind of revenue you can generate off? What does that look like for YouTube? Do you know?
So I think for him, he said he does like about $5 for 1,000 views in terms of advertising. So if you do $5 for 1,000, that's 5,000 for 1,000,000. He does $500,000 to $1 million in just ad revenue for every video that comes out in the first month. If he puts out 30 videos, it's like, you know, so but not only does he do the ad revenue from YouTube, which is actually, I think, a smaller source of the revenue, he'll often have an ad within the video where he's promoting something. So he's like, buy the Samsung phone because it has a really good camera, or, you know, download the Honey browser extension, or get this app. And kids will just flock anywhere. He is literally just the more – something he's talked about is the most he can generally charge in a video for promoting a big brand is like $2 to $3 million. That's kind of like his going rate if you want to promote something in a main channel Mr. Beast video, which is good money, right? But then he says now that the influence gets bigger and bigger, it's like he wants to charge more, but the big brands just can't – like don't have the budget or aren't used to it. They can't justify in their minds – paying for like a Super Bowl prices to be in a Mr. Beast video. So he's like, he says, I don't feel like I'm getting the right price, which is part of the reason he wants to just build his own product so he can promote it and get all the value there. So like, you know, he has the audience. He's going to build stuff to sell them. The chocolate's going to be the big thing. You know, it's going to be huge.
It's fascinating. How old was he when he started? Wasn't he like 11 or 12 when he started doing YouTube videos?
Yeah. So he kind of grew up with a single mom. He wasn't wealthy at all. And he said, like, you know, he was always obsessed with being a YouTuber. Some cute thing he did on his channel is, like, when he was 10 or 12, is he made videos for his future self, 1, 5, 10 years, 20 years into the future. And literally as like a 12-year-old, he's like, when you're watching this 10 years from now, I hope to have 1 million subscribers. I hope this and that. You know, so this guy is someone who's lived and breathed YouTube over his entire life. The way he started getting a little big is when he had no money, is he just tried to do these viral stunts like, I'm going to count to 100,000 with the camera on. You're going to watch me count for 70. I'm going to say this name 100,000 times. I'm going to like see if I can stay underwater in a pool with an oxygen mask for 24 hours. Like I'm going to fill up like 1 million Orbeez and the thing. Like just these little viral stunts. And then as he started getting more money, partly from like brand deals and stuff, he moved more into like these viral philanthropic stunts. So he gave a homeless person $10,000 randomly and just recorded that. Then he, you know, a year later bought a homeless person a house. He goes into a restaurant and he, you know, just orders water and tips first $1, then $10, then $1,000 just after ordering water. It's like, you know, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it's like, you know, I'm going to give a Lamborghini to the last person to remove their hand off a Lamborghini. Here's $1 million in cash, 10 people, the last person to take their hand off gets $1 million. And just bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, you know, and then he did a Squid Games recreation where he had 400 people come to like a mock set of the Squid Games to compete to win like $500,000. And now he says like he's literally spending, it used to be maybe a year ago he'd spend $500,000 on a video. Now each video generally is like $2-3 million in production costs and just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And like, you don't like see this, like, and it just, we're in uncharted territory now for what he's going to do.
Well, and that's his goal. I heard him sit there and say he doesn't, he's never viewed the climbing revenue as wealth. He's viewed it as more fuel to put back into the videos.
Yeah. Every podcast he does. And I've watched all of them. He says like 10 times, my goal is just to create the best videos possible. Everything else is to fuel that goal. And what's crazy is like, I think people think real celebrities are kind of cooler than YouTube celebrities. Like, you know, no one's going to match like how like a real main, but like Tom Brady's is in his videos. Justin Timberlake's in his videos. Kim Kardashian, he was even photographed with holding the Feastables. The most popular people. And what all these celebrities say is like, Tom Brady was literally on a podcast with Mr. Beast. He's like, you know, Tom Brady said, Mr. Beast, I'm a huge fan. My kids watch you. They think it's so cool when I'm in your video.
Right.
So,
like, yeah.
He's more popular than the real celebrities.
Yeah. No, yeah. Tom Brady. Tom Brady gets street cred from his kids by being on Mr. Beast videos, right? I mean, that's exactly. And I think that that will help people contextualize how big this guy really is and how powerful these YouTuber, you know, marketing. It's amazing to me that people doubt it still, just because it is. I get 5 years ago, right? And I was probably one of those guys that was a little more suspect. But you've just seen examples of this over and over and over. And not only do I think, like I was saying, not only do I think that they're going to be viable competition to these bigger companies, I don't think the bigger companies are the predator. I think they're the prey. I think they're the ones who have got the deck stacked against them. And look, I could be proven wrong, but you know, if watch this guy's videos, watch the way, go talk to kids of any age, 9 to 15, right? Maybe even younger, but go talk to them. What do they think of Mr. Beast? Incredible. What do you think of Hershey's? Rather have Feastables. You know what I mean? Like it just seems to be the way it is. Is he going to, does he have plans to spread this out into any other type of products? I mean, I'm assuming he's not just going to stop at chocolate bars. I would imagine he's going to develop other candies, you know, a suite of products inside of Feastables.
So good question. Obviously, they're a little guarded and they don't want to explicitly say the roadmap. They did release like this, like these mini cookies you could buy, like in this big bag. That didn't really like get a lot of attention. What he said, I listened to his podcast interviews to try to, like, you know, get a sense of where he's thinking. He's hinted that they want to launch a direct Reese's Peanut Butter Cup competitor. In a podcast with Howie Mandel that came out earlier this week, Howie Mandel, the former Deal or No Deal host, was in his office, Mr. Beast's office, and say, like, look, I see on the wall you have a list of, like, all your competitors. And he's like, yeah, this is a list of the 100 best-selling Hershey chocolate SKUs. Hershey has 70 SKUs that are doing over $10 million a year in sales. And it's like, okay, so he's clearly thinking, I want to look at what all the big Hershey's products are and go down that list. So, you know, he has the 7 chocolate brands, the 7 chocolate bars right now. He's going to definitely do a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup competitor. I think he said that he's only focused on chocolate but for the next year or two, but he just wants to innovate probably with more chocolate stuff. So we're almost certainly going to see a Reese's Peanut Butter Cup competitor. We're probably going to see something we don't know about. The big thing is for candy is Halloween is a huge, huge, like half your sales can come from the 2 weeks around Halloween. So how are they going to innovate around Halloween? This year, they tried to do like a candy bag, but they were retooling the formula, so they didn't promote it that much. It's going to be really, really, really interesting to see what they do around Halloween and if they release like some special edition thing. I don't know exactly what they're going to do, but my guess is we're going to see some like Halloween innovation.
See, yes, Halloween innovation. I love that. What and we're getting close to the end of our time here, yeah. So I know you're a busy guy. What any other aspects of this? I just think I love the investment side of it because I think it's fascinating. So one, are there any other aspects of this? And like you said, Hershey's been declining for a while. Is there any discernible difference in that rate of decline since this Feastables has come on? Like, can you see any pass through there or are we seeing any evidence of it yet?
Great question, Zach. And like now it depends on where you sit. I think they had in their Q4 a 5% volume decline in North America confectionery. Now, I would argue that some of that is being driven by Feastables. What they said in their earnings announcement, this is just cross price elasticity. We raise prices, so volumes go down. They're also saying that they're doing an enterprise resource planning system upgrade where they're like changing the way they like do their software and whatever. But to me, these are like the early stage because they don't want to say the thing that'll make Hershey stock fall 20% in a day is Michelle Buck, the CEO, will be on an earnings call and say, our sales are down and it's down because of Feastables. And then everyone's going to be like, oh, shoot, I have a competitor. It's not like a one-time thing. So I think it's starting to show up in the numbers a little. I think it definitely will show up later this year, and that's going to really catalyze the stock drop. So yeah, but no one talks about it. They're going to say, oh, the market is bad. There's inflation. Consumers are holding back. It's Wegovy. It's blah, 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 blah. But then eventually it's going to be too big where they can't ignore it.
Yeah, until Mr. Beast makes a bid for Hershey's. Yeah. Okay, so real quick before you go, and I know you can't, you know, I know you can't give it away. I know you can't unveil, but I also know that there's probably some other things you're working on. And again, you don't need to get specific, but just give us a little teaser here. And you can speak sector wise. You can speak anything else popping up on your radar now that's gotten your interest, even if it's not fully cooked. But just give us a little taste.
Something that I focus a lot on is businesses with like auto renewal policies or like unethical auto renewal policies. So the kind of quintessential example is a gym, you know. So gyms, you know, like Planet Fitness, you can't cancel online or over the phone or like in an app. You need to go in person to cancel. And even when you do that, they try to play games. And oftentimes they try to get your debit cards. You can't even dispute the transactions. I think there's going to be a lot of businesses that suffer over the next year or so because from like this unethical billing type stuff when there's a crackdown on it. The Biden administration has made it a top priority to get rid of junk fees and businesses that are unethically billing people. Credit cards are getting more and more smart about sending you notifications if an auto renewal happens at a higher price or an unauthorized charge. It's easier to dispute. Soon debit cards will have better dispute mechanisms. I think we're going to see a lot of businesses kind of get hurt by that. I think there's going to be some businesses that have been hurt by AI that are just going to zero. I've criticized Chegg. There's probably going to be other ones like maybe call centers that get really hurt by AI. And then I do think there's going to be a lot of downstream effects from these GLP-1 drugs that are like appetite suppressants. Like, you know, healthcare is just a huge part of the economy. Obesity is actually like a huge negative risk factor for like needing future medical expenses. If people actually get healthier, like could like health insurance like change? Could like, you know, hospitals get hurt? Like, I kind of wonder if there's going to be a big downstream impact from that. So those are just three general areas.
Well, say, you know, it's interesting on the auto repay ones too. This would seem like a perfect storm for them because, like you said, the Biden administration going after those guys. I would also think in this environment with inflation and costs being up, people have got to be going through their own personal ledger and trying to find where they're still paying those auto payments, right? It's like it's an easy way to eliminate, you know, some wasteful spending. So I kind of see those kind of things converging, and that seems like that would be a target-rich environment looking at those kinds of things.
Absolutely. I think Planet Fitness in particular, the CEO and CFO both left. They have an interim CEO. It's a franchise model. They're constantly getting in trouble on social media for being woke. We'll see what happens there.
Yeah, man, bad PR for them. That's just bad PR. Look, and there's a subset of this of society that won't see that as bad PR.
Yeah.
The problem is if 40% do, that's a problem for a company like Planet Fitness, right? Yeah, they're. I never understood where. Well, that's chalk it up with a bunch of companies. That was one of those where you looked at the multiple and just went, "What?" Mm-hmm. You know, it just didn't make any sense. All right, pal. So I've kept you a little over here. The folks can follow you on Twitter. It's just at Edwin Dorsey, correct?
It's at Stock Jabber, but Google Edwin Dorsey and I'll come up. Yeah,
at Stock Jabber with two B's. And then they can go to the Bear Cage. How do they access the Bear? So you've got the free one, which I don't understand why anybody wouldn't log on to or subscribe to that.
Yeah.
But also the paywall, which I think's got phenomenal value. Give us the deal on both.
Okay, so the best way to find the Bear Cave is just Google the Bear Cave newsletter. It'll come up, or it's thebearcave.substack.com. But Google the Bear Cave, it'll come up. Everyone should read the free version of the newsletter. Every Sunday, you'll get a weekly recap of what's going on in the short world. You'll see other people criticizing unethical companies. You'll see notable or suspicious resignations, and oftentimes are quite humorous. And I'll share some like interesting tweets that might serve as some sort of idea generation or be educational. A lot of people, even if they don't invest, they love the educational value of the free newsletter. And then the paid one is a little steep. I charge $640 a year for the paid version of the newsletter. It mostly appeals to people with a more professional investor background or hedge funds. But if you're looking for new short ideas, or you just have a lot of money and you like seeing like, you know, how somebody researches and does deep work, it can be educational. It'll show you how to do good work. You'll maybe get a good long idea somehow from seeing like where the unethical corners of the market are. Maybe it saves you money by helping you avoid investing in unethical or scammy company. So I hope everybody at least will just Google the Bear Cave and check it out and see if it's funny for them.
Yeah. And truthfully, I got to tell you, $640 a year ain't that expensive. Not for the content. No, I just think it's a really good deal. And it's not that expensive for the information you're putting out. And no, man, I think you're doing great work. And I'm a fan of it. I think it's intriguing. I think it's fun. I think you do very thorough, thoughtful research. So it's just always fun to have you on, man. And best of luck. And I'm going to be watching this Hershey saga. I may even need to, and I'll let you know if I do this, but in my personal account, I may need to initiate a short on Hershey because.
I'd love to know, you know, if you see anything with Hershey's, if your kids' friends all turn against it, DM me. I need to know it.
I will. I got to do some more looking. It just kind of seems a little bit like a fat pitch.
Yes. They're for the taking.
I love it. All right, guys. Well, hopefully you enjoyed this as much as I did. Edwin, thank you for coming on, man. It's a blast as always to have you. And I hope, like I said, hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. And got another great interview lined up next week. You're not going to want to miss it. Until then, have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.